This is an interview with Mrs. Hannah Sechel, S-E-C-H-E-L, 542 Ridge Pike, Lafayette Hill, 19444. This is tape one, side one, March 26, 1981, Nora Levin interviewing. Corrections. This is 1982, and please spell Mrs. Sechel's name, S-E-C-K-E-L. Mrs. Sechel, can you first please tell us a little about your childhood, where you were born and when, and a little about your family background?
Okay, I was born in Czechoslovakia.
In what town, please?
I was born in Kolín, which is like 60 kilometers out of Prague, but I moved when I was 8 months old, which I don't remember, to Prague.
How do you spell that, please?
My K-O-L-I-N.
Thank you.
My grandparents, both my said grandparents lived in that town. My parents then moved before I was 1 year to Prague. My father got into business. My mother was 19 when I was born, so basically I had a very young parent. I had a brother who was 4 years younger than I. And I think that as all middle-class Jewish families, the education, the religion, and the family circle was very important to us.
You had just one brother?
I just had one brother. My mother was out of seven. My father was out of three. We were a very close clan with the whole family. There were no holidays where not everybody got together. Except that when my aunt, she divorced, and that was Große Schande. And another aunt married a Gentile, that was even worse. Actually, she was the only one who survived, except me. So the family closeness was very important. We were always taught you do not do anything bad, or so to speak, or out of line, because you would shame the family. So we had a very close ties with the family, which I think our generation doesn't understand at all.
Was it an observant family?
No. No, I think we, you know, just celebrated the holidays, but no, we didn't keep kashrut at all.
Did you go to the synagogue?
Yes.
On the holidays?
On the holidays. As a children, you know, as a girl, when I was little, I was allowed to go to the men's section with my dad. That was sort of a very highlight thing. When I got 10, I couldn't, and that was sort of a heartbreak.
Why?
Not to be able, because then I had to go to the women's section.
At 10?
Yeah. So,
did you go to Hebrew school or Sunday school?
No, because in Europe that was a little different. You did not have, community didn't support a synagogue. You paid taxes. Every religious group was taxed, so we had a Jewish tax, and thus the synagogues were supported, or any religious institutions, and a fund drive. But in the public schools, you had your religious instruction always, which meant you had it three times a week, the first hour of the day. And it was a pretty, for the Jewish people, the rabbi or the Hebrew instruction, the Catholic, the nuns came in, and the Protestants, and the one who were non-believer, they got to school an hour, 2 hours later.
I see. And your brother also had this kind of
we all did
religious education.
So we went to regular public school before the Jewish question arose.
And what do you remember of your relations with non-Jewish children in the school?
No different. When I was in elementary school, from fifth grade on, when I had to go to another school and probably met diversified people. As a child, I remember I always was taught if somebody calls me dirty Jew or another word, don't say anything, don't make waves, take it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And somebody spilled ink on you or put your pigtails into the inkwell behind you because you were maybe Jewish, maybe related to the other. But because we're Jewish, don't speak up, don't say anything, take it. Okay, don't make
Were there such anti-Jewish episodes from time to time?
I really cannot recall. I mean, mm-hmm. it was sort of, maybe, I don't know, maybe we developed the immunity to what's being called a dirty Jew. I do not recall that somebody would personally cast me or be vengeful to me because I was Jewish. I cannot recall that
at
all.
You had some non-Jewish playmates, I suppose.
Yeah. School was, as I said, Catholic, Protestant, and Jews.
And then the fifth grade, something
The
happened.
Fifth grade, then you moved to different schools, and like here you moved to high school, you moved to different schools, you passed an exam and could go to different school. It wasn't too bad because then I went to a French school, completely French schools, where all the subjects were taught in French. And this was outside of my neighborhood. And I do not, really do not recall in school being very much abused of being Jewish.
There weren't many Jewish children in such a school, I would suppose.
Yes,
there were.
Many
French
Jewish
rather
people.
Than German was the
French,
preferred language for upper
No,
class.
German was. No,
German.
We had always all the Jewish families read a German Jewish newspaper, which was published in Vienna,
mm-hmm.
and it was called Prager Tagblatt. Maybe it was published in Prague, I don't know. But that was right. We always had a German-speaking maid. Governance. So we have been brought up bilingual and eventually trilingual. Don't forget that my parents actually were the first generation of Czechoslovakia. Before that it was the Austrian Empire, Hungaro-Austrian Empire, and the official language was German.
Mm-hmm.
For the official paper, so everybody spoke German rather than Yiddish. I never spoke Yiddish until I came to the States. That's where I learned it.
But the interest in French was cultural.
The French was, you know, toy, upper class. You had
the language of diplomacy.
And so on. So you, from fifth grade on, I met some pretty nice people, pretty nice kids. And I do not, but I got myself very much involved in the Zionistic youth movement when I was like 10.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks to that, I really am here. But I was very much involved in that, always after school and running to Maccabi Hatzair, which it was called, and we're learning Hebrew and singing all this. Palestine was Palestine and Israel at that time. And
do you remember what attracted you to the movement, Hannah? Was there an inspiring leader?
First of all, okay. When you, like in school, you didn't have sports.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the parents always looked out that their children should not just get the brain, but also the bra. And there was a sports organization in Czech which was called Sokol, S-O-K-O-L, who did not accept Jews, like the country clubs here. But the Jewish people had their own gyms, and that was called Maccabi.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go there after school 2-3 times, red, blue and white shorts we used to wear. And I think through that, I really don't know how I got into it. It seems like I've been it all my life.
Mm-hmm.
Through that, I think there was an outing or something like that, and I
got
caught up in it, and I went to camp and had really the pioneer spirit, the Hashachar, where we slept on the floor and ate from the same pot for 5 weeks and
really chalutzot.
Right. Anachnu chalutzim all the time.
Yes.
And I stuck with this. My parents were very unhappy about that.
I was going to ask.
Extremely, and every time, where are you going? I'm going to a meeting here and there, and who is going to be there? First time I really broke loose, and...
They were not Zionists.
They were not Zionists. They were very... They didn't give me too much, at least, maybe I was so caught up in it that I didn't pay that much attention how heartbroken they were, but they were certainly not very supportive.
Mm-hmm. And your brother, did he?
My brother was 4 years younger than I, so when I was 10, he was 6, so it really didn't matter that much to him, but...
This was very meaningful for you.
Yeah, I was, I found my niche, and...
And your parents...
And as a matter of fact, most of my friends who survived, who are in Israel, are still from that era.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Here's one.
And can India. You tell me a little about the life of your parents in the pre-war period? They were comfortable economically and socially.
Yeah.
And happy in their life? Well,
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult to think back what you saw as a child.
Yes.
I was very happy. We did a lot of things. My parents were very sporty, other than we went skiing a lot. Particularly my father was into the European football. We used to go to football games, played football. Mm-hmm. We rented in the summer, every summer, a summer house. We took the whole household, including the maid, to the summer house.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very much into the outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I recall ever having any serious arguments or disagreement or hearing any in my house. Maybe they did it when we were asleep.
But it was a serene household.
I had a very happy childhood and a good relationship.
What was father's business?
My father was a doctor.
And so his patients were Jewish and non-Jewish, I presume?
I do not know.
You don't know?
I do not know.
And would you know if they had any non-Jewish friends? Socially? You weren't aware of that point?
I recall some dinner parties in the house, but you know, at the time the children were seen but not heard, and if there was a party for the adults, you just did not mix into that
mm-hmm.
At all. You said hello, how are you, and good night, and say hello, and shake hands, and make a curtsy, and go away.
Can you tell me a little about the neighborhood where you lived?
We lived in, actually, across a church, but within the boundaries of where they call it the Alt Neu Synagogue, the Old New Synagogue.
Oh, yes.
Could walk it right across a main street there.
Yes.
So with, from our windows there was a church, but it was, I think it was sort of mixed. Maybe the half a street later was practically all Jewish. Mm-hmm. But we lived in an apartment house, and I had a maid who lived in.
And you could walk to school?
To elementary school, but to the from fifth grade on to the French school, I had to either take a streetcar, or if I wanted to save money, I walked it, which was about an hour. Walk.
And what year are we speaking about? When did you enter the French school? Approximately.
36.
And you were then about 11.
Yeah.
And so...
I stayed only 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Well,
then
now you come to, 2 years later you come into 38.
Which
was, of course, the Sudetenland was occupied, and
how did that affect your family or your life?
I think it did. I think, first of all, I think it affected it before, because we had an aunt who was in Vienna, and they came to live with us. They escaped from Vienna, and suddenly we were like, you know, two families in one apartment.
I see.
Also, it started affecting us long before that, because the maid just left. Okay, well, we were told as kids that we are big enough, we don't need a maid, but...
there were other factors, yes, undoubtedly.
Yes. But there was, and so my aunt Helena with her family, they came from Vienna, and they were telling us how things are. And of course everybody was saying that can happen in Austria, but never, never in Czechoslovakia. We are a democracy, we have a democratic president, and this will not happen. But there were a lot of people coming, particularly, I think, I don't know, because I didn't live anywhere else, but I thought that in our neighborhood there were a lot of strange Jewish people coming, and suddenly it seemed like the streets were more crowded.
Yes.
What happened in the other neighborhood, I don't know.
And they were coming mostly from Austria, do you suppose?
Austria, a lot of people came from Poland.
From
also.
Poland also.
Yeah, many. Yeah. And,
you were aware of what happened in the French school, and you were saying that in
the
middle 30s.
So then, of course, and you also ask how, and then, of course, when Sudetenland was occupied and there was a general mobilization and we had to leave. I mean, I don't know, under Czechoslovakia, there was a mobilization in 38 and we had to go to the country. They thought that the city is going to be bombed. And what affected us also that we all kids, we had to walk with gas masks. Everybody had to buy a gas mask. But that's not the Jewish question. It was just a question that the war is coming on. And we had all these exercises, the gas alarms instead of fire alarm exercises, and some put them a gas mask on and how to go under the desks in the classroom and all that thing. But as far as the Jewish question was that in 1938, the Jews were not allowed to go to public schools anymore. There was a decree that you cannot attend school anymore.
This was a Czech government decree?
No. I might be wrong. March 1939, where we were occupied in what became Protectorat Böhmen und Mähren, and the decree was pretty soon after that the Jews cannot attend schools.
That was after the destruction of the Republic,
right?
Actually,
yeah. But the mobilization was 38 September, and it was March 30.
And
March.
Father was involved in that mobilization. You don't remember. And when you say you were
I remember that just the kids and my mother, we just wandered out of the city and... Into the countryside, yeah.
And then between September 38, the time of Munich, and March 39, when the Republic was destroyed, there was...
A lot of things were brewing.
Mounting.
A lot of things were happening. For my part, you know, in the Zionistic organization, we got a lot of Shaliach came from Palestine and was telling us what's going to happen. And I came home and my parents were saying it's a lot of propaganda, you know, they all want you to go to Palestine. Nothing is going to happen. They just are painting the whole thing black in order to get the young people into Palestine. And
did you want to go at that time?
Oh, yes.
Father? You did?
Oh, yes.
Did any of your friends go?
All my... No, not directly, no, because first we had to go, like, we had a certain camp, like a summer camp, like my kids were in Yam Judea camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to go to the training, and in 1938 I went to a camp, my parents let me go, and... Summer 1938. Yeah. 1937. I'm really not well prepared.
That's all right.
1937, 1938, I went to the camp where we really lived a Chalutz life. I loved it. It's great.
And you really were getting yourself ready to go to Palestine?
Oh, yeah, I learned
mentally,
Hebrew.
You learned Hebrew.
We studied constantly Hebrew and studied the whole political situation to the chagrin of my parents instead of studying the French. And 1939, summer, okay, now the protectorate became March. Still went to school.
That's 39.
39 until May.
Until May.
And 39 in May, I came to school. No, excuse me, that's all wrong. 1939 in March. April. I went to school, and I get to school, and the whole school is full of German troops. They eliminated the French school, and they used it as the headquarters, as the Cassiana. So we all were sent home, but not by the virtue of being Jewish. At the time, the French school was, there was also an English school, and that German army took on. And they said that we are going to have classrooms somewhere else. That then happened, except for the Jewish students. The Jewish student could not attend. I really do not know where the classrooms, where the classes were held. The school, the physical school, was occupied by the German army. We got there one day and that was it, and we were sent home. As a matter of fact, I do have still sort of like a paper here where it says the school has been dissolved. But apparently there were still some classes somewhere else, but then it was that the Jewish people would not go, could not go.
To so any public school?
To any or public school, but there was a Jewish school. There was a Jewish school which was started, which apparently, because I have some people now in age who remember, you know, who taught there, the very young women of 17 and 18 who became teachers, and they was established a Jewish school for Jewish children.
You attended that?
Did not attend that because this was April and I didn't want to go. I just was going to the Zionistic movement and I was saying that I'm going to go in September to school. Now we are 39, September 39, but then I started being very active in the Maccabi Hatzair and still wanted to organize a summer camp, which we did. 1939, so I never went except that we used to get together and just learn, but I didn't go into any formal school.
Yeah. And what was happening to brother? What is your brother's name?
My brother's name was Peter.
Peter. And what was happening to his life during this time?
His life was, I like to think, I'm not sure, but I like to think that he was extremely brilliant, he was, because he wrote a lot of poetry when he was even like 10, 11 years old. He drew beautifully, he drew beautiful cartoons. He was
talented.
Very talented. And he went to a Jewish school. He hated it.
He was not interested in those things.
Oh no, he just, I think that he hated that he had to get out of his school and which he had loved, and to go to a Jewish school. And he started going for the small children into the Maccabi Hatzair, to the Tzofim. And it's funny because my daughter now is the regional director for Zionistic movement, so I always keep telling them I brought them up, and they have a career out of that. So I pursue this all my life.
Yes.
He was much more he could find happiness sort of within himself. He did a lot of writing and poetry and so on, so he could. He was schlepping along as my younger brother. So, what was the question?
About your brother and his writing. He started a newspaper.
He started a newspaper for the Maccabi Hatzair, Zionistic movement, and he attended the Jewish school. How it affected him emotionally, I really didn't find out until sort of later, when I was in Denmark. That's when I sort of started to find out. And my parents, I remember there were sort of like a lot of clandestine meetings in our house. I think they were trying to get to Uganda. I remember studying about Uganda at that time because we had relatives in Cincinnati, Ohio. That's how I came after the war to America, who they tried to get, you know, papers and get to America and get a visa here and get an affidavit to here. But nothing was moving out of America. Papers were not coming, and
very few Czech Jews were able to come to this country.
I do not know. I cannot really answer. All I can answer is for my own family.
Were they thinking of Palestine as an alternative? Do you know?
I cannot answer that in all honesty either. I know there was a lot of talk about Uganda. We had to study Uganda because they were accepting Jews there at the time.
Is
of
that
all
so?
Places.
Yes.
I remember because there was such a strange name for me, you know, Uganda. We kept saying it over and over and again. And
so, you know, the British had offered it to Jews in 1905.
Yeah.
And so this was a revival of the idea, possibly.
But then, of course, my grandmother had a sister here in Cincinnati, Ohio, so they were trying to get here and get the papers here, but the wheels were just grinding too slow to save many people that way, as far as papers were coming from here, the affidavits and so on.
Was father's business practice affected after March 39? Was he able
not
to practice?
Not yet.
And were you aware that Jewish stores were being closed or taken over?
Oh yes. Well, we wore the star and all that stuff, you know. We did.
As early as March?
No, not as early as
a little
March,
later.
As June or something.
June 39.
Yeah. We wore the stars and the stores had, you know, this is a Jewish store, the sign, and you wouldn't get shot.
But Jews were still able to operate their stores, do you think?
Yeah, except that they were not allowed to have any Gentile employees. Also, our ration cards were different.
Was there curfew, do you remember?
Mm-hmm. There was a curfew, but it was not steady. It would be like 1 week curfew, and the next week there wouldn't be a curfew. It was sort of
erratic.
Whenever the fancy strikes.
Do you remember that your relations with non-Jewish children or friends were affected, Hannah?
Yeah, well, I don't know whether they were affected. I think that we started to stick more to ourselves. It was sort of like a natural progression that you started to sever all your relationship with the non-Jewish people, non-Jewish, they were not playmates anymore.
Friends,
yeah.
But
you sort of gravitated more towards your own at that time.
But your parents were still able to keep their apartment through the fall of 39.
Oh, yeah. And after I left, they still had their apartment.
And so you stayed in Prague until when, Hannah?
October 39.
And then what did you do?
I went to Denmark.
Why Denmark?
Well, you see, that's actually what happened was that in the summer of 39, I still went to camp.
Mm-hmm.
To the Maccabi Hatzair camp and came back. In any camp, we sort of came back and
had
we
Denmark
started thinking
been,
about immigration.
Had Denmark been discussed there as a transit?
No.
No.
Because we were in Hakshara, and because we were going to Palestine, we had to learn farming. Okay? And the League for Peace and Freedom, the International League for Peace and Freedom, put in that they are going to take a certain amount of children between the age of 12 and 15 into Denmark to teach them farming.
I see.
And that's how we got to Denmark.
This was not connected to any Zionist movement then, but quite
independent. No, it was in a way because the Zionist movement submitted the list to the League of Peace and Freedom, which wouldn't.
Continuing our interview with Mrs. Hannah Seckel. Excuse me. Hannah, I was asking about the League, this association that sponsored the agricultural training program. I asked if it was linked in any way with the Zionist movement. And I think you said
that... Well, the League itself wasn't, but the League did of... fight against any kind of persecution. And they did say that they would accommodate so many young people, they used to call them children, it was like a kinder aliyah, and to train them in Denmark in agriculture, in farming. And the Danish League for Peace and Freedom did contact them. Undercover Zionistic organizations because they didn't exist, sort of. And they in turn contacted us youngsters who were there. But there was a price to be paid for that. They just, you know, you had to buy yourself out or buy yourself into Denmark or buy yourself out of Czechoslovakia. So it was really up to the parents of the children whether they could afford to pay for this expensive emigration.
And your parents then were required to pay the League for this privilege.
I cannot answer whether it was the League or whether it was also partially supporting the Zionist this organization, but I know there was a high price to be paid for that.
And your parents paid it, of course.
Yes.
Were many other Jewish families involved in this, do you know, Hannah? Or was
well,
it too expensive?
There were three transports going.
In 39?
In 39, to Denmark.
And
there
about how many...
transports also going from Germany.
And about how many children in each of the three transports?
Yeah, about close to 100.
Close to 100?
Yeah.
And your brother, was he interested?
He was too young.
He was too young.
Go. There was a specific, I just was lucky I fell into the age requirement.
So you left in October?
I left in October 39.
Must have been a wrenching separation from your family.
Well, you know, looking back and being now old, for me it was a fantastic adventure. And looking back, I many, many times in my life I said, how selfish was I?
But you were young.
Well, and it took me years before I even could even think about how my parents must have felt about this. It took me years, even wanted to see the picture of my parents on the platform, on the train.
But you had no idea a war was coming or that you'd be separated?
Oh, yes.
You knew?
The war broke out. We left after the war broke out. You left in end of October.
Yes. Poland was invaded, of course, in September.
Oh, yes, the things were going really bad, and we knew they were not going to get any better. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
But
yes,
for you, going to Denmark was...
Well, I was on my own. I was just 14.
14.
And we sat on the train and we sang Hebrew songs and going through Berlin, and we were in this compartment all closed in.
It was an intense experience.
I was in love with somebody and he was on the train, and then, you know, you got there and you broke down. But
were you able to maintain contact with your parents
mm-hmm.
by mail?
Because then in April, Denmark was occupied. And so they became the Großes Deutsches Reich. And so there was constant mail contact, and I still have all my letters. And when I came home after the war, I found all my letters that I sent home. And I still have it, it's all yellow and so on, but I have every single letter which we had, we corresponded.
Where in Denmark did you stay when you got there?
Well,
were you taken to a farm?
We're taken to a farm. Want to see pictures?
Of course, if we could do that a little later.
Yeah.
Where in Denmark?
Gørløse, Per Gørløse. Gørløse. And it's a umlaut O. Per, P-E-R. Small P-E-R means like post office, and the same thing, Gørløse. And the farm was an unusual Danish farm because there was neither running water nor electricity.
Was it near any city or town?
It was near Hillerød. That was the closest thing.
Can you spell that?
H-I-L-L-R-O-D, umlaut O. The Danes put like a slash through the O.
No running water?
No running water, no electricity. And no, nothing but Danish spoken, no other language.
Were you with your comrades?
No, the thing is that somehow happened that two of us, a boy who is now in Denmark, stayed in Denmark, and I, we were shipped into this little village. Now he was a little luckier than I because he was shipped to a school teacher. We were met at the train, the two of us, by a priest when we came from Copenhagen to Gørløse, by a priest and a school teacher. They came to meet us at the train in their
regalia.
And he stayed with the school teacher, whereas I was, I don't remember, I was driven by horse, cart, to this farm.
To the priest's farm?
No, another farm.
To another farm.
And they had four children, and they needed a maid, and here I was put into the position of being the helper.
And what happened to the other children in the transport?
The other children went to another village.
Were they all scattered, do you know?
We were all scattered, yeah.
All scattered.
All scattered.
Of course, this is not what you had in mind when you left.
No, we were all scattered. Actually, in Copenhagen, the representative, Mrs. Nielsen, Frau Nielsen, Fru Nielsen, she met us and we were running with those signs. And this one goes this way and this one goes this way. And
I see.
So, but the two of us were the only one who went on this train to the town. And the other ones went to another town, which was called Nestve, but they were sort of closer together. But this boy and I, at the time we thought it was far away. When I came back, it wasn't really that far away, but we thought it was far, far away. And there were just the two of us trying contact. They did have a phone, though, which you cranked up by hand and called the operator.
But you knew no Danish?
I didn't know no Danish. And the winter was extremely severe. The snowdrifts were extremely severe.
Must have been a shocking experience.
I had a completely unheated room, sort of outside, and I did all the farm chores and going to pump the water in the morning, and the pump, which was absolutely frozen. And
did you have any warm clothing?
Yes, we were allowed to take like 50 kilograms with us, and then we didn't have any boots or anything like that, so we always had to ride to the league and ask for boots, but they sort of collected clothing for us.
Did some representative come from time to
Once in a while they should come.
To see how you were
there
faring.
There was a Fru Oppenheimer, I remember her name. She came, but we always used to make fun of her, as kids, because she never did anything for us. You know, she would look our name and says, yes, I sent you a pair of boots, but it didn't. So we had these wooden shoes, and we stuck them with straw to keep them warm. And the farmers was pretty much disillusioned with me, because I really did not know anything. I did not know any farming, and in the morning you had to cook this oatmeal porridge, and I did not know how to do that.
Coming from an upper class?
Pumping the water and then boiling the water, or in the morning you got up and you pumped the water in the evening. And so you could have water for cooking in the morning and you start your fire in the morning in the kitchen. But the water was, even in the kitchen, was frozen deep, so you had to hack that ice. And it was pretty cold. My room was so cold that in the morning my sheets were frozen from my breath, my blankets were frozen.
Good. So you were in the main house or in a barn?
Well, I was not in the main house, and I was not in the barn. I was like in the servants' quarters, which were not heated. Actually, the house wasn't heated either, because you just kindled your fires.
For each
individual room, or you took a brick and stuck them in the stove and then
took it to bed. Yeah. Did you get enough to eat?
Yeah. Oh, I got fat.
And how did you withstand the cold? Or did you come down with colds that first winter?
I withstood it.
You withstood it?
I withstood it, yeah.
And were they relatively kindly people? Or?
I can't tell, because we could not communicate at all.
You didn't learn much Danish then?
Yeah, well, of course you do start learning. Eventually I went to school in Denmark. But
those first few months must have been very tough.
It was very hard. I cried many a tear. I didn't want to write home any letters. Everything was fine when I wrote home, because I know they had more than their share and they wanted me. They were happy that I was out of that situation. Until April 40.
Did you hear then from your parents? Constantly. The mail got through.
The mail got through. As a matter of fact, my parents were so that they sent the farmer also some presents for Yule, which is Christmas in Danish. Mm-hmm. And
what did they write about their situation?
Most of the letters were censored.
So they couldn't say much.
brother who did a very good cartoons at the time, and sort of enclosed cartoons in it, which I still do have. And so I could, you know.
What were your parents writing?
It's an odd thing because maybe it's not, because it took me, I would say, good 30 years before I even started to reread the letters. I just didn't want to.
I can understand that. We'll pass.
The situation was so that, you know, this was taken, that was taken, and the jewelry was taken, and could go out on the street only such and such hours, and the ration cards were taken, and then three families and four families and five families moved into our apartment, to the concentrated ghetto. And about the selection, this one was selected to go, and these ones were selected to go, and this family isn't here anymore, and if the family moved, you knew where they moved to, because you knew they couldn't get out of the country, so the only way they could move to was into the cattle car. So,
and
yes, but
were you in
then,
touch with some of your own, excuse me?
Yeah. April 40, Denmark was occupied. And
how did that affect your life?
In the beginning, terribly, but you learn to live with any situation.
Were you allowed to stay in the farm?
I recall this quite vividly. Suddenly one morning, there's a whole German army marching through the field into the farm. Cavalry on horses. And they settle themselves down in the barn. And I crawl under the bed, not literally, but I just didn't want to get out of my room. The farmer knew that I speak German, and he wanted me out there to communicate with the
German
soldier.
He knew, of course, that you were Jewish.
Yeah, but I don't think that ever was a question. Before World War II, except for the white Russians who came to Denmark, there was no Jewish question. The Danes are not very religious oriented, or more or less Lutheran. They go to church once a year on Christmas, and there was nothing.
Very little.
Particularly in the farms, in the in Copenhagen, there was a synagogue, which I did not know until much, much later.
But there was certainly no Jewish problem in Denmark.
No, they just probably felt that, you know, the Danes at that time are very good-natured people, so they just felt sorry and they took us. And not only that, but you know, we were a helping hand. I mean, we didn't get paid.
You didn't?
No.
Just your board and keep?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we didn't even have money for stamps, you know, to send letters.
You had to get that from your parents?
Yeah, they used to send this international reply card where you could go to the, you know, you can go to the post office and change it. But that, no, we didn't get, we had, no money. No money whatsoever. I mean, really, no money.
Was this considered a fairly prosperous farm?
No.
No.
I don't think so, because when I didn't stay there. I stayed there until June, and then I moved to another farm.
And I interrupted you. You were about to say the farmer wanted you to speak to the Germans.
Yeah, and I said, no, I will not do that. Well, you see, that it was very... For the farmer, it was very advantageous because the German would pay a lot. And it was, you know, farmer did not know their money was worth nothing, but they printed their money like crazy. And they would pay three times, four times the market price of anything which they wanted. They did not take it. They would pay for it with the Deutsche Reichsmark. And it was a very nice thing for the farmer to do. And I would not go there.
So how did he negotiate?
How did he negotiate? I don't know. He called the school teacher where this other boy, the boy was in, and he complained to him that, you know, that about that he asked me to do it, and I do not want to do that. The Germans stayed on the farm, I think, like 1 week, and then they moved on. They supplied the horses, and they supplied themselves we slaughtered a lot of pigs at the time, which I learned how to do too, and make sausages, which I learned how to do. And they took a lot of hay for their horses, and then they moved on.
They didn't molest you or the farm family?
Mm-hmm. No.
How did you get on with the children?
They thought that I was unique, crazy, different, which I was. But I got along fine because, would you believe, this was my first Christmas present from the farmer, 1939. A silver spoon.
Okay. This was their name, Borg?
No, that's the castle.
Oh, that's the castle. I see.
Yeah.
Frederiksborg.
Yeah. That's where Hamlet.
Is that so?
Mm-hmm. Is about. So it was right near there, which I did not know at the time. Well, anyhow, so you cannot move around unless you learn how to ride a bike. I never knew how to ride a bike. So here, they got me an old, dilapidated bike, and I learned how to ride a bike. And in the winter, we used to put rope around the tires instead of snow tires, and I rode the bike that way. The snow was very, very deep that winter. And
so you stayed with this family until June?
June 40. And then I moved to Nestville, where there was a whole nucleus of the Hashakar people.
And you did this on your own, Hannah, or were you instructed to do it?
No. You see, at the time when you left on a farm, all the farm help, not the seasonal farm, but was contracted for 6 months at a time. So you could only move.
After the contract was over.
Even the contract was a non-paying thing, but you could not move. And so I got in touch with some of the kids who were in Estwell, and I said, I would like to go, you know, near you. But they had a Pegeshot, and they had a Madrich who came from, I think he was financed both by the League and by the Zionistic organization, which was extremely, extremely small and extremely poor of funds. And of course, now don't forget, it was all the German occupation in Denmark. But they had a Madrich who came around to these centers where the kids were once a week or twice a month. We go together to learn something. Either was math or very informal reading, but mostly it was all Zionistic teaching, a lot of Hebrew and Hebrew conversation. But we got together at least.
Oh, that must have been such a
relief. I wanted to go there, and I did. You had to get a permit from the police to move from one place to the other, but I got that. And then I came to a very nice farm.
In Nestville?
In Nestville, yeah, near Nestville. I had a very good friend who was not on a farm. She was sort of like she was adopted girl of a music teacher in Nestville. The farm was outside of Nestville. Of course, Nestville is a little town. and she lived with a family in town. Oh my God, you know, go to village and go to town was really quite a treat. But the woman she lived with was a music teacher. Yeah, anyhow, talking about music, because there was no electricity, there was no radio. And when I came to Nestville, first time in a long time, I heard music, and it was really quite something for me to hear just somebody clambering on the piano. It was I envied her that she was there. And they really liked her because she was not like a maid there. She was like their adopted daughter because they didn't have any children. She lives in Canada now. Mm-hmm. So still in touch with them.
So this new place was
this was
pleasant.
A very nice farm, and
the work you did was not quite so hard.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was the same work, but it, you know, to kindle the fire, to work on the fields, to milk 14 cows by hand in an hour, that was the goal, and
also
to take care of the chickens. They had thousands of chickens. I learned that. And I think my worst job was always to empty the latrine. I hated that job.
It was an outdoor latrine.
Outdoor latrine. I hated to go there. Well, you know, people have done worse in concentration camp, my
but
goodness.
But still, you were
but
six.
In the winter, I loved it because it was all frozen. But in the summer, I just hated it because it was so full and I had to lift it up and it spilled all over the place.
Oh, my.
But I also lived in the servant quarter. I ate with the family.
And your room was still unheated?
My room was still unheated. As a matter of fact, that room was even worse because there was this, the wall, the outside wall, when it comes together, was cracked. So the oil was coming in.
Cold air.
It was, but they...
But you ate
they made
the
me
thing.
A birthday party. And they invited all the chavarim. So that, and they were very nice. They also
was there electricity and water?
Yes, there was electricity.
This was
and
in warm water.
Not warm water, but there was no warm water. Used to wash the clothes. They had a washing machine which was run by hand. That was more than on the other farm. And I remember putting the thing, the clothes in the machine, boiling your water, bringing the water into the machine, and turning the machine by hand. And I always said after 15 turns, I have to know 15 Hebrew words. This is how I was learning Hebrew, yeah.
Yes, an excellent routine.
So, and then...
Were there children in this family, Hannah?
The farmer was a newlywed.
I see.
See, on the farms, it works like this. If you inherit the farm from your parents stay on the farm. If you buy a farm and the people are elderly, they stay on the farm too, and they have like their own
quarters. I see.
This, the name was Newgord. He was one of 13 children. The parents, it was a fantastic family. His parents were school teachers. They lived in the schoolhouse. It was one-room schoolhouse. And they kept adopting children. At the time, there was the Finnish-Russian War. And they adopted, the one who had 13 children adopted two other Finnish orphans from the Finnish-Russian War. So they had, but all the children were from the age 30 to age 1. That son was the oldest one, just got married, and he bought this farm. So the owner also lived on the farm in his quarters on that side, and I lived on the other side. Mm-hmm. But they had a baby then when I was there. But they were young. They were like 19, 20 years old.
And you were in touch with your comrades during that time?
Yeah, with the chavarim, yes.
And still hearing from your parents? Until when?
41.
41. And they were still in Prague until 41. What month?
September.
September. Were you hearing any news about the war during this time?
Well, you see, they did, the farmers were, it was very interesting because first they were a lot pro-German, very much so.
How do you account for that?
I think they got a lot of money because the British, when they're exporting, like they're exporting the pork or the bacon or anything to Britain before the war, Britain had very stringent requirements, and you know, the pig had to be fed to exactly that same weight, so the bacon is exactly that way. And the German took it the way it was, and they paid more than the British did. Now, I do not know at that time I did not know at the time about all the underground which was going on in Denmark. That I did not know until like 42. I did not know about the sabotages which were done in the big cities. That I did not know. I only lived in this little tiny world.
Yes, perspective.
So it would be extremely unfair to say to me that all the Danes were pro-Germanic. All I know is just where I lived.
But culturally there was a closeness too, I think, between Danes and Germans prior to the war.
We didn't really meet any adults except the people where we lived.
You didn't get into town?
I got into church on Christmas, you know, to go to the midnight mass, and went to a couple barn dances where the farm boys came. And I had no clothes because I started developing. I developed very fast, and I used to run with safety pins all around because I had no clothes at all.
And so you stayed on this farm until when?
You see, I was very hungry. I think we all were, for some kind of education.
Of course.
At that time I spoke Danish, I wrote Danish and so on.
You just picked that up?
Yeah, well, you live in it, you pick it up. And I wanted to better myself, go higher in life. And I wanted to do two things. First of all, work as a maid in the city, which I thought I would like to do. And second, I wanted to go to school. So I started. I still wanted to stay within the agricultural field because I was going to Palestine.
That was still your aim?
Yes, we all did. But what happened was this, that in 1941, we got, and I do not know from whom, I really have to ask my friend in Denmark because he keeps fantastic records of what happened to all of us, that a transport is going to Palestine, and they were transported by 30. And we were going to go because we couldn't go any other way because the war was gone. We were going to go to Sweden, to Finland, to Russia, and that way to Palestine. In other words, the eastern way. And we got our papers, and the little luggage was sent, and
this
we were going. That's 41.
41.
They picked 30 people to go, and one transport went, and they got stuck in the Finnish-Russian conflict.
Had to come back?
And they had to come back. Some of them